hey there, hi there, ho there, we're as happy as can be. You know, all these things from my childhood, you know, when I go back and look at them, like Captain Kangaroo. You think this is off topic? Come on. Captain Kangaroo played for like 30 years. And I loved Captain Kangaroo. So Catherine and I will have discussions about some of these old cartoon shows and people that were on them. Today will be a pretty simple Q&A. A lot of times I'll take something and do a more topical approach. Today I have some great questions. I'm going to mostly answer them. There are a couple short studies that I do want to talk about because I think they're extremely important. But the questions, we've got heart problems, we have bleeding problems, we have congestive heart failure problems. We've got unexplained pain, which those of you that watched, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, when I talked about BI pain, that this will fit into that conversation very, very well. I also want to talk about a study that was done by someone that I had studied with, on a particular type of acupuncture called neuropuncture for tinnitus, or sometimes pronounced tinnitus, that persistent ringing in the ears that nobody knows how to get rid of. In this study, they got phenomenal results with a particular acupuncture, neuroacupuncture treatment. It's a treatment that I use and have gotten good results. Also, I want to talk a little bit at some point about Lyme disease. And, you know, if that turns you off, realize you may be misguided. The number of people with unexplained illnesses that are explainable by Lyme disease and co-infections is astronomical. And I'm going to talk about how and why those are under and misdiagnosed and how dangerous that is for the population at large. And one of the things we're seeing with COVID, for example, and some with COVID vaccines, is that, in this case, mostly with COVID itself, that we're getting massive reactivations of illnesses that people thought they had gotten beyond, such as Lyme disease. They'll go through a treatment for Lyme, their symptoms go away, they think they've got it conquered, they get COVID, and all of their Lyme stuff comes back. Or they have Epstein-Barr that's really affecting them. The Epstein-Barr ceases to become a problem. Then they develop COVID, and lo and behold, the Epstein-Barr is back. And there's a whole list and litany of problems that can be reactivated post-COVID infection. So very important. And I'm going to talk a little about Lyme disease and how it's just hideously, hideously underdiagnosed and misdiagnosed. So you're welcome to keep sending in questions. I've got quite a few here. And as we go through, if you have something, Catherine will ask me or hand it to me, and we'll see if we have time to fit it in today. And that's always the case, by the way. Always get your questions in. So here's a question from an old patient. She's not old, but she's a former patient, and had some very interesting problems, largely gallbladder-related problems, although there were a few other issues with connective tissue. And so this is a great question. It says, 1 year ago, I got accidentally kneed in my left outer shin just below the knee. MRI and x-ray showed nothing, but a year later, I'm still having pain after any attempt at exercise. It hurts a bit when I'm exercising, but especially that night, it just throbs and feels like electric shocks going down my outer shin muscle. Physical therapy didn't help either. Any advice on what to do? Well, those of you been hanging around with me for a while on radio or in person in my clinic or here on the Q&As, know I always have a response. And I will have advice. Now, I mentioned this person has a history of gallbladder issues and connective tissue issues, as in Ehlers-Danlos type problems where the connective tissue develops differently. And there's a little bit of hypermobility of the joints. Now, in this case, my question would be, is the pain right along the shin bone, or is it down kind of the middle of the lateral side of the leg, right? And so the reason that I would ask that of the patient is if it's down the shin bone, that's a stomach meridian issue. And if it's down the gallbladder, the other middle part of the leg, it could be a gallbladder channel problem. And if you remember when I was talking about B syndrome, I talked about lots of things that could cause it. However, it is classified as a B syndrome, where there's a blockage that creates pain. Now, the saying in Chinese medicine is free flow equals no pain. No free flow equals pain. So this is one of those cases that is often much better treated with acupuncture than it is by any Western medical treatment. Anytime you have a problem and the doctor can't figure out what it is, right? You have pain somewhere. CAT scans are negative. MRIs are negative. X-rays are negative, et cetera. That's a great time to go to your acupuncturist because it may be a problem in the meridian system. And we can often fix things without having to rely on sophisticated medical testing. Now, I love sophisticated medical testing, but again, one of the joys of acupuncture is we don't have to rely on it at all, particularly for pain syndromes. And so here, I would want to know which location that's in. I would suspect that it's probably on the gallbladder channel since there's a history of gallbladder problems. And so then one of the things that intrigued me about this question is I have the same problem. I hurt my knee years ago. It generally is okay. And occasionally, like I went on a weekend away with my wife, we went down to Pacific Grove. We belong to a club called Anytime Fitness, which has fitness clubs all over the world. We went to a brand new club down there. I mean, it was shiny and bright. The people were shiny and bright, and it was just awesome. And so, of course, I got carried away and worked my leg harder than I would do here because they had all new equipment, and it was really cool. Well, by that night, I was pretty much crippled. We had a second floor motel room. All I could do to get up the stairs. It took me quite a while. My wife ended up driving me home. It was her birthday, by the way, weekend. She ended up driving me home and then driving all the way back down to Pacific Grove to be with her family. And my leg was just blown up. And so in my case, there is a B syndrome problem in that I had surgery on that knee 50-ish years ago. And ever since then, I've had a blockage in the stomach channel, and it's still numb along that channel. And so that is part of my issue. Now, it could also be, so that's where I would start, would be getting work done on the stomach and gallbladder channels, more so on whichever one is problematic, but I would do both. Also, in my case, I can feel the head of the fibula in my leg. That's the smaller bone that's on the outside that goes from the knee down to the outside or lateral ankle bone, malleolus. And I can feel movement in there. And so what it feels like to me is that I have ligament instability. So ligaments hold bones to bones. Tendons hold muscles to bones. So I have feels like I have ligament instability, and my knee joint actually moves out of place. And then it swells because everything gets blocked and I have a lot of pain. So for me, I'm very careful with that knee joint. It's something that can even go out while I'm asleep. And so I have to be very careful of my posture when I'm sleeping. So I would have someone that you trust do a really good physical examination of the knee and see if there could be lax ligaments. Now, lax ligaments are not going to show up on an X-ray. They usually won't show up on an MRI. They will show up if there's a lot of fluid around them from inflammation. And so mine would show up on an MRI because it gets very inflamed. But you could have this ligament instability that's only a problem while it's flared up. And by the time you get in for the MRI, it might be fine. So that's where I would go with it. I would look at ligamentous instability, and I would look at getting acupuncture or acupressure on those channels to open up the B syndrome. There are also lots of formulas, herbal formulas, that specifically work on the knee and the lower leg. So lots of opportunities here. I also might try massaging it with magnesium lotion with arnica. You know, magnesium is very relaxing. It gets in and moves the fluids, very powerful for cramping, for tendon issues, et cetera. And then the arnica is a great blood mover. So that combination, you're moving qi and blood and fluid. So that's a very powerful combination. We go through gallons of it around here. It's just fabulous stuff. This is another patient that I have not seen in a while. I'm going to read it to you. One of your old patients, glad you're doing this webinars again. And I have a question for you. My brother was hospitalized 2 days ago with shortness of breath and was told that his hemoglobin was very low. So hemoglobin, all of the red blood cells of the body should have, and most all, almost 100% do, have hemoglobin on them. And hemoglobin is a chemical to which oxygen binds. And so when the oxygen, when you're breathing it in, it will get stuck, I'm going to say. It's going to get bound to the hemoglobin on the red blood cells. As the red blood cells move through your tissues, it will release the oxygen so that it can nourish your tissues. If you have low hemoglobin, you will have low oxygen in your system because it can't carry the oxygen. And here it says, after a blood transfusion yesterday, it's still low at 6.7. 6.7 isn't low. 6.7 is an emergency. And if that's after a transfusion, that is quite scary, actually. All labs report different numbers as being standard ranges or reference ranges, but typically you'll see a number more like above 11.5. So if you get down even to 11, it's considered low hemoglobin and is anemia. With the 6.7, that's so low that one would not be able to function properly. Thought processes are probably off, cloudy headed, et cetera. Not always. Some people have become used to low hemoglobin over some period of time, and then they adjust better than if it's an acute case. His wife said, because it was still low, they want to do another blood transfusion, probably necessary in this case. My brother told me they also want to do a colonoscopy. When I asked him why, he said they told him that the colon had something to do with the oxygen levels and can contribute to the cause of the shortness of breath. Well, they didn't do a very good job of stating that. So one of the primary reasons for low hemoglobin is from bleeding disorders. So if you have an ulcer, if you have a problem in the colon, you would bleed into it. And so you would lose red blood cells. And when you lose the red blood cells, you would also lose hemoglobin. So what they're looking for with the colonoscopy is some source of bleeding. And that's very, very critical. Again, when you get a hemoglobin level, which that was post-transfusion with 6.7, so who knows what it was beforehand. But when you get a hemoglobin level that low, that is an emergency event. And you have to find what the problem is. Now, there are some non-bleeding causes that could be at play. And I would love to see the rest of the lab, which would tell us. For example, if he has a normal number of red blood cells and this hideously low hemoglobin, then we're probably looking at another problem. He's probably not bleeding. There's probably a different issue for the low hemoglobin because he has enough red blood cells. So colonoscopy is absolutely necessary here. They'll probably also want to do an endoscopy. Often they'll do it both at the same time. So the endoscopy, they go through the throat and go down. And obviously the colonoscopy, they go through the bottom and go up. And if you do both of those scopes, you're very, very likely to find the source of any bleeding. Other causes of bleeding can be ulcers, either in the small intestine, the duodenum, or in the stomach, or bleeding varices, which are veins that have become engorged in the esophagus. And so those can also bleed. So I'd be surprised if they don't also do an endoscopy to take a look down from this side for ulcers and varices. My brother's had several health challenges for years: enlarged heart, high blood pressure, gout, rheumatism, and in the past 6 months has developed shortness of breath and edema in the legs. Enlarged heart, that can be caused by the high blood pressure. At any rate, it's caused by the heart having to work too hard, usually. It can also be caused by certain infections. Myocarditis, an infection of the muscle tissue, can cause it to be enlarged. Excess exercise, since the heart's a muscle, excess exercise can cause it to be enlarged. From what I'm hearing here, that's not likely the case. It's really much more likely from the high blood pressure. And with high blood pressure, in particular, certain chambers of the heart will become enlarged and can actually become misshapen, and that will affect blood flow. Because the heart's enlarged and there's been high blood pressure for a long period of time, this sounds like, unfortunately, your brother's going into congestive heart failure, which has many, many other names for it, but I use the older name, congestive heart failure. And with congestive heart failure, you're going to get severe shortness of breath and edema in the legs. The edema is because there's not enough pressure pushing the blood to put enough pressure for the blood to return upward through the veins toward the heart. And so it will tend to, the blood pools and then the water leaks out. Often with that, you'll see a condition called stasis dermatitis also, if that's there long enough, and you'll get blistering of the skin. Rheumatism, gout. Okay. Should get the gout treated. There are a couple of medications for gout. Colchicine and allopurinol. Allopurinol is generally given for more chronic conditions, and it is relatively safe to take long-term. Colchicine, much stronger, usually used on an acute basis to get the uric acid down quickly. So in gout, in gross simplicity, what occurs is the uric acid builds up in the bloodstream. That's usually because of an inability, a genetic defect in breaking down purine rich foods. So it was traditionally called the disease of kings, because you had to be wealthy to be able to afford the food that would cause gout. So these are organ meats and sweet meats and some shellfish, alcohol for sure, all very, very causative for gout. So as the uric acid builds up, you would die if it gets too much acid in the blood. So the body, in its infinite wisdom, causes crystals of calcium urate to form and get precipitated out into the tissues. So that's great for your blood. It'll keep you alive. The problem is you have these incredibly sharp shards of minerals that get stuck in your joints and in your tissue. And so about 50% of the time it's in a big toe, but it can appear anywhere. I had one patient who had a severe gout in his thigh. Nobody could figure out what was causing the pain. Finally, he had surgery and they pulled out an enormous crystal of calcium urate out of his thigh. But most commonly, you're going to find it in the big toe. There are a whole list of naturally occurring compounds that are very effective at lowering uric acid levels and lowering gout risk. A couple of the simplest ones are celery or celery seed extract. I tried eating celery seed and boy, that was, yeah, talk about bitter. But you can get celery seed extract in capsules. Tart cherry juice is very, very effective for that. And lithium orotate, which is not the lithium we think of for bipolar disorder. It works quite differently. One of the things it does is it lowers one of the inflammatory chemicals that causes a lot of the pain in gout and also reduces the inflammation. That combination, we also have other herbs that we use, but just a combination of celery seed extract, tart cherry juice, and lithium orotate, we've had great, great results with. Okay. Rheumatism could be highly related to gout. It doesn't say what, you know, what type of rheumatism, but gout will cause a type of rheumatism. It affects the joints and will cause the release of certain chemicals, interleukin 6 in particular, which can then cause inflammation and literally erode the joints. So it would be great if your brother can talk to somebody back there. I see he's from Indiana. I would recommend that he talk to a naturopath. I don't know if they license them in Indiana or not, but I would look. And if not, then find an acupuncturist who has expertise in this area, which not a lot do. I have a lot of expertise, but I would recommend you get it treated because all of these things go together. And with some simple lifestyle, dietary, and supplement changes, he might be able to really put a lot of this stuff, not necessarily into remission, but really lower the severity. Okay. And you're a great sister for doing this for him and doing the outreach. So, and here the question is, my question is, what does the colon have to do with breathing? Well, for most of us, nothing directly. I mean, Wim Hof's always coming up with something new. So he's probably got colonic breathing of some kind. And I'm being sarcastic. I really like Wim Hof. But the reason they're, again, they're doing the colonoscopy is to look for bleeding. And if there's bleeding, that would cause him to lose red blood cells and hemoglobin and would make him anemic. And as I said, it's very hard to get this anemic without something fairly serious going on. They will probably, if they haven't already, put them on some form of water pill like Lasix to get the fluid out of his system, lower the edema a little bit. But the shortness of breath is absolutely, it would be impossible not to have shortness of breath with this list of problems. Okay, next thing I want to talk about, little change of subject here. It's an article which I have followed up on and read the actual research. And this is a paper that was presented at the 3rd Annual Congress of Infectious Diseases. And it starts out, simple test for Lyme disease may be more effective than current guidelines. If you all want a great read, a suspense-filled, factual book, you got to read the book or get the Audible. Like this is a book that really works well on an Audible.
Good.
Yeah, very good. Catherine just got really excited when she read it or listened to it. It's called Bitten, B-I-T-T-E-N, like something bites you. And it's about the gentleman who says, and he's very bright, and I find everything he said to be very believable. But he was interviewed, and Lyme disease has been around for millions of years, but he modified it to make it weapons grade, and that it was really a weapons program, basically. And he did not know that that was the true reason it was being developed. I don't know. I think it would be hard not to have a clue, but that happens all the time. And here's the problem. It's impossible for me, in my lowly position, to know if there are so many things that I don't know if they're done out of ignorance or if they're done for reprehensible reasons, because they would look the same. What I do know is that the currently generally accepted testing to prove Lyme disease is not good at all. So there are different, there's something called bands, okay? So there are levels of Lyme disease testing. The first level is very inaccurate, maybe 30%. The second level is pretty inaccurate, maybe 60% accurate. And then there are some other techniques that are 100% or close to 100%, but they're not generally used. And so in this second test, a Western blot test, it will come back with what they call bands, right? Numbered bands, band number 39, number 40, number 41. And there's no agreement. So the CDC says X number of bands, and this changes all the time, but 3 to 5 bands have to test positive, and they have to be of a few of those bands. Now, they publish a bunch of bands, but they say to prove Lyme, it has to fall in this very narrow window of several bands. California has different requirements. New York has different requirements. The company that invented the test has different requirements, right? Now, think about that. Depending on what state you get tested in, you can either test positive or negative. And the testing company has different values. They created the test than are used by many of these sources. So we already have a problem. Again, the question is why? Is it an honest mistake, or is it that they want to underdiagnose Lyme? Again, I can't say. I don't have that highest security clearance, but it looks suspicious to me. I still get patients who come in who clearly have Lyme disease. They have all the symptoms. They end up testing positive, and their doctors refuse to run the test because they say there is absolutely no Lyme disease in the Bay Area. Well, what you can look at a map and it will show you Lyme disease endemic areas. You can go on a hike to any of the national forests in California, any of the campgrounds, and there will be a big sign saying beware of ticks, and it'll have a big picture of a tick, and they talk about Lyme disease. Now, why would they go through all that trouble at all these places if there was no Lyme disease here? It's interesting. I had one patient, probably my most well-intentioned patient. This guy was in his around 60s. He was a general contractor. He worked, 40-hour week carrying heavy stuff. He would get up at 3 a.m. and do his yoga. He'd go for a 10-mile run. He ate perfectly. Everything was perfect, except he was getting more and more fatigued, and he had a couple of other little weird things. I figured he had Lyme disease because nothing else fit. Sure enough, we test him. He had Lyme disease. His doctor said that was ridiculous. There's no Lyme disease around here. Within the next year, 5 people on his block were diagnosed with Lyme disease. So he lived over by Woodside, lots of woods, lots of shrubbery, lots of deer, and lots of deer ticks. So, it's kind of weird. If you go to other places, they assume everything is Lyme. Right? When the truth, like most things, is some middle ground. But I had noticed many years ago that patients that came to me with Lyme-like symptoms and had one of those bands test positive, and it's band 41. That's been my fave for over a decade, 15 years probably. If they tested positive for band 41, they had all the symptoms of Lyme. When we treated them for Lyme, they got better. Well, here in this study, I didn't forget, getting back here, testing for an increased cluster of differentiation 4. Okay, what they're looking at here, there are different kinds of cells that respond to infections or insults to the body. And so what they're saying, if they have a particular ratio of CD4 to CD8 cells, and they have a positive immunoglobulin G band of 41, may diagnose Lyme disease more effectively than the current guidelines, according to a recent study. And it lists the person and the study, and it goes into great detail. And what they were saying, 148 patients that were evaluated this way for the correlation between the inflammatory ratios and band 41, it was almost 100% of them tested positive later for Lyme. And that's kind of their point. And I've discovered that too, that patients will come in, we'll test them, they'll come out positive for band 41, they will come out positive for these ratios, and then within a year or 2 years, the rest of the bands will start to pop up. So you don't want to wait. If you get a positive band 41, if you've ever had a Lyme test and you had a band 41, then you just need to get your CD4, CD8 cells tested. That's a relatively inexpensive test that can be run by anybody that runs lab tests. Have those done. And I can't tell you how often Lyme disease is at the root of problems that patients present with. Kind of my rule of thumb, if someone comes in and I diagnose them for not Lyme, but for other things, and I treat them for 90 days and I don't get the result that I expect, I assume they have Lyme and test them for it because it's such a joker. It can show up as anything. It kind of plays out of the box. So if you've been chronically ill, fatigued, muscle pain, joint pain, brain fog, and you've ever had a Lyme test and you were positive with band 41, then follow up with one of your practitioners and get your CD4, CD8 cells tested. Now, this study, Catherine will, as she always is so wonderful with this stuff, will put a link to this so you can find it and maybe take it to your doctor because they're probably not familiar with it. Oh, we have some questions. What do we have?
I have to get breast radiation. What is the best thing to drink or do while doing it?
It depends on whether it's the left or the right breast and which and what you're getting radiated for, because the strength of the radiation is somewhat of a determining factor. Now, the good news is radiation for breast issues has advanced by leaps and bounds. I have many female patients who had breast cancers 15, 20 years ago, who had their left breast radiated and then developed heart problems. We've got patients on pacemakers, all sorts of valvular problems, et cetera. And fortunately, the doses used are much more tightly concentrated now and much better controlled. So that's good news. The main thing is radiation kills cells, and that's its job, and it creates massive amounts of inflammation in the system. So you need to make so all of those cells that are dying or being killed by the radiation on purpose will go into the lymphatic system. That's the basically the sewer system of the body. The breast area is very, very full of lymphatic nodes and channels. And so one of the keys is to get those dead cells out. Okay. We use something called circulation cream that we have women massage gently into their breast. The radiation can burn you, so you got to be careful. And then you need to make sure you're doing something for the liver to clear all the gunk out of the liver from these dead cells. I would definitely use some form of binder. A binder is something that will stay in your intestines. And so as these toxic molecules are getting passed out of the liver through the bile and into your intestines, the binder will grab them and carry them out of your system through your stool before you have an opportunity to reabsorb them, because the body reabsorbs a lot of stuff out of the intestines. My favorite for this situation, and there are many different binders, but for this, I would use chlorella. I would use relatively high dose. I can't tell you what that is because different companies will dose it differently. But we have patients that in a case like this might do up to 50 or 60 chewable capsules or chewable tablets a day, because you really want to coat that your intestines. And you would do that in three divided doses per day. That, I think, is the most important. Then you want to do herbs and there are supplements that are going to help clear the liver. At the top of that list is a supplement, is N-acetylcysteine or NAC. Definitely would want to do that. And then there's a whole array of Chinese herbal formulas that can be used to clear the toxin out of the liver. You must keep the bowels open. You've got to poop a minimum, I mean, a dead minimum of once a day. Three times a day would be better with this. If you're not pooping that much, we have a combination of vitamin C and magnesium called Buffered C. It's pretty much foolproof and it will wash everything through your system. Just those three things, the N-acetylcysteine for the liver. I would also do some milk thistle for the liver. It's the best hepatoprotective or liver protective. It actually has saved people's livers who got mushroom poisoning. So that would be four things. So I do milk thistle, N-acetylcysteine, chlorella, and the buffered C or something to give you really regular loose bowel movements during this time. And those are really, I think, the most critical things. Okay, so I think that's my best suggestion. Okay. And I'm sorry you have to go through that, for sure.
Yeah. Do we have time for another one?
Sure.
Okay. I've been going to acupuncture for B syndrome, cold damp, for the past 2 months, twice a week. During the appointment, the doctor is able to clear the channel and pain goes away. However, a day or two later, the pain is back. Perhaps this is the instability in the tendon you just explained. Any insights?
Could be a variety of things, but it's certainly, I mean, the medial side of the elbow, when you have pain there, that's often called golfer's elbow, right? So if you have pain when you turn the elbow this way, that's tennis elbow. When you have it, when you turn it this way, that's golfer's elbow. It's just because if you do a bad tennis backhand, you get pain in the outside. If you do a bad golf swing, you get it on the medial part. And that can be very tricky. So at early stages, one would feel pain with pressure on the muscle and tendon coming down from this medial epicondyle here. So you'd feel pain in here. If you feel pain right on it or just below it, that's often a little bit more difficult situation. And if you've ever eaten chicken, I'll say, and you get a drumstick, and you'll see this thin, it looks like cellophane around the bone, okay? That is actually what the tendon hooks onto. That's where the connection is. And if that gets damaged enough, it can actually pull loose a little bit. And that takes a lot longer to heal. So you want to do alternating heat and cold. In between, you want to do massage. I would, again, use magnesium and arnica oil on that. I think is a great choice. It's a real simple one. And massage it into that area just to assist the acupuncture. So the fact that it's working at all is a really, really positive thing. But with some of these tendon problems, as you said, as soon as you stop treating it for a day or two, it'll tend to come back. Now, I have problems in this elbow, and I'm just massaging it while I talk to you. And I want to thank you because I feel much better. This is great. So I would look at it from a combined Western and TCM perspective. Okay. Next week, I'm going to talk about the treatment for tinnitus. If you don't have tinnitus, sorry to tell you, the odds are you will end up with it. And I'm going to talk about some very, very effective treatments. And really, Western medicine has nothing to offer for that. And then I'm going to talk about a document. It's a study titled Therapeutic Effects of Chinese Herbal Medicine Against Neuroendocrinological Diseases, especially related to hypothalamus, pituitary adrenal, and hypothalamus pituitary gonadal axis. So any of you that are interested in the idea of adrenal fatigue, pituitary issues, hypothalamic dysfunction, problems with gonads, with the sexual organs, you don't want to miss this one, because I'm going to talk about some stuff that very, very few people realize about Chinese medicine and the treatment of these conditions. All right. So I look forward to talking with you next week. I'll be back at 3 o'clock on Thursday. Until then, be happy, be healthy.